Okay, thank you very much, Paul. It's really a great pleasure to be here today. It's not easy to give the very last talk on Friday evening, and I want to thank the audience for staying until this very last talk. I hope you don't leave before the end of this talk. I will do my best to keep you interested. So the talk today will be on brain shape analysis and registration. And it's a collaborative work with many people. So I will cite the people involved during the talk. And I will also put the references to the published papers. And I made sure before I left that all the references are actually available online on our website. So I will essentially provide a survey of a number of registration methods that we've developed in our group during the past 5 or 6 years. And show how these methods can be combined with a number of methods to detect and quantify anatomical and pathological shape variations. I will also illustrate this with a number of medical applications, and in particular the patient follow-up, image-guided neurosurgery, some atlas construction from cross sections, and then mapping towards medical images, brain asymmetry, and I will end up with a study on variability of sulcal lines. So this is the overview of the organization of the talk. It's highly nonlinear, as I will be very brief on the first part, geometric registration. I will then talk about iconic registration, hybrid method, combining the two, and end up with shape statistics and tensor computing before I draw some perspectives. So geometric registration, also called feature-based registration. We started actually influenced by computer vision approaches working on this type of methods, where you have two main stages. The first stage where you extract geometric primitives from images, and these primitives have to be invariant for a chosen group of transformations, and typically this works for rigid transformations. And then the registration consists of matching homologous primitives together and at the same time estimating the transformation between the two images. So her work provided a technique for extracting so-called crest lines and extremal points from volumetric images. And these lines or these points are defined as the intersection of two or three implicit surfaces. One of the surfaces is the anatomical surfaces, which can be a thin pulse thresholding, for instance. The second surface is defined as the locus of points where one of the principal curvatures, typically we take the one with the largest magnitude, is extremal in the associated direction of principal curvature. So this gives this criterion, and the zero crossings of this criterion defines this blue surface here. And the third implicit surface is defined by a similar criterion for the second principal curvature. So when you use only the first two implicit surfaces, you end up with the so-called crest lines, which are points where the surface actually bends, has a maximum bending. And if you take the third one, you have on these lines extremal points, which are also singular values for the two curvatures. So here we see an example of the extraction of these crest lines on a cortical surface of a high-resolution MR image. And the description is very compact. Typically, we go from 1 million voxel to a few thousands of points. And it's invariant by displacement, so then it can be exploited by some registration algorithms. These registration algorithms are, for instance, adapted algorithms from computer vision, and we've shown that it's possible to develop some geometric hashing, for instance, or prediction verification techniques, or ICP-like algorithms to establish the correspondences between homologous points and find the best rigid transformation between the two images. And typically, these algorithms are very powerful because they can use additional invariants computed along the crest lines and on the underlying anatomical surface, exploiting the fact that these lines actually are on surfaces on which we can compute the principal curvatures. So for instance, we can use the curvature of the lines, the torsion, all the angles between the Frenet frame and the Darboux frame, and things like that. So this is typically the technique that we use to align rigidly images, high-resolution images of patients for longitudinal studies. For instance, here, a sequence of 24 MR images of a patient with multiple sclerosis. So here we see a cross-section at a given height before alignment. And here's the totally automatic rigid registration of these images. And now the cross-section is taken exactly in the same physical plane. And usually, because during the study, it's often the case that the parameters of the MR machine are changed, it's then necessary to do some intensity correction, which is easily done once the registration of the images are done. With this type of techniques, actually, the method is usually the methods are very robust with respect to intensity variations, as long as it's possible to extract these crest lines or extremal points in all the images of the sequence. In fact, there are some advantages of these techniques. Totally automatic. They don't require any initialization. I mean, you can start with one image in one position, the other one flipped 180 degrees with respect to the first one. They are usually very accurate and robust. Accurate because you're matching hundreds of points and looking for a rigid transformation with only six parameters. And so we showed that it was possible, for instance, to do this type of rigid registration with an overall accuracy, which is typically one-tenth of the voxel resolution. Unfortunately, these methods are quite limited. They require very high resolution and low noise images because you have to compute high derivatives, typically up to third-order derivatives in the images. Also, you need to have invariant landmarks, and typically this works for rigid transformation because these landmarks, for instance, are based on curvature. For monomodal images and single patients, a possible exception that we found was for skull images, where these crest lines actually have a very strong anatomical meaning between individuals and could be used to register images between several individuals. This is what we showed with Gérard Subsole and Jean-Philippe Thirion, where we made actually the fusion of a database of skull images obtained with CT scan. Also, we showed with Gérard Subsole that it was possible to use these crest lines to track I was through aging or through ages, because here it's through a few years and for a given child, and here to match actually skull shapes between a contemporary man and a Totavel man several hundred thousand years ago. So because of the limitations of geometric methods, we moved to, with many other groups, to the iconic or intensity-based methods. And the first work in our group was done by Jean-Philippe Thirion. This was a Demons algorithm inspired by the pioneering work of Christensen, Miller, and colleagues. And his idea was to get similar results with a very fast algorithm whose complexity actually is in linear with respect to the number of voxels. The algorithm works with two main iterated stages. The first stage, where there are a number of image forces which create a displacement field. It's based upon normalized optical flow and a regularization stage done by Gaussian filtering. So it was very empirical approach, but with very good results. To be a little more formal, starting with the identity, the first stage creates a correction field given here by something which looks like the derivative of SSD or sum of square differences criterion, and a regularization which can be either after the correction, after composing the correction field with the current transformation by Gaussian filtering here, or directly by convolving the correction field with the Gaussian and then composing with the current transformation. So mimicking somehow the elastic and fluid regularization of the work of Christensen and Miller. At this stage, it's interesting to remark that by construction, this the norm of the correction field here is smaller, the magnitude is smaller than half of a voxel. And this is the reason why this algorithm is, as we shall see, preserving the diffeomorphism of the overall transformation. So this work was then put into a variational framework, first by Penek and Cachier, and recently by Moderzycki in his book, which I recommend here, which has just been published. And they show that actually there is a global energy which is minimized by this algorithm. So for instance, Moderzycki shows that this the energy which is minimized is a sum of two terms, an SSD-like similarity measure, and this classical regularization term under some specific boundary conditions. The next stage was introduced by Pascal Cachier with the introduction of auxiliary variables similar to the ones introduced in 96 by Laurent Cohen to actually formalize the alternate minimization of the Demons algorithm while preserving its efficiency. So the idea is to have actually two deformation field, the C deformation field and the U deformation field, and to alternate the minimization with respect to C and to U. And so the minimization on C is done assuming that we have an initial U deformation field. And this is done by the differentiation of this criterion with respect to C, and this can be done by a gradient descent, first or second order. And the minimization on the U field, if then done, given correction field C, there is an explicit solution by Gaussian convolution. It's also possible to refine the approach, actually combining fluid and elastic registration, and introducing a number of filters that were discovered by Pascal Cachier and are published in this paper. So the nice properties of this approach is that there is actually this is an optimization approach as the ones presented by Olivier Forgeras this morning, with the alternate minimization of a single positive criterion. So we have the convergence after possibly an infinite number of iterations, but convergence still. The algorithmic complexity is linear with respect to the number of points, and I will show you later, I will give you some computing times on a parallel version of this algorithm. It's really fast. And in fact, we just by construction, we ensure the diffeomorphism properties of the final results. Doing this careful gradient descent, I mentioned that the correction field is smaller than half the size of the voxel. There is the Eulerian scheme for the interpolation and the properties also of the regularization filters, which are low pass, and which maintain these nice properties. Also, Pascal Cachier showed that it was possible to construct energies which are symmetric with respect to the two images, and which ensure that you find compatible results working with ING or JNI, both for the similarity term and the regularization term. And I will show the effectiveness of this approach on a longitudinal study in a minute. So having this type of intensity-based or iconic registration algorithms, it's then possible to introduce differential operators to the deformation field to detect and quantify non-rigid brain variations. For instance, if you simply compute the Jacobian of the found of the deformation field, you will separate between regions where you have a rigid transformation locally, where the Jacobian is equal to 1, from regions where there is an apparent local expansion, and regions with a local contraction. So we applied this idea to the previous longitudinal study on multiple sclerosis. And here we have a close-up around this lesion here between two registered images at time I and I plus 1. And here is the apparent deformation field. And if we look also at this video, we'll see at various cross-sections the deformation field applied to a grid. And you will see that visually, there are regions where we have a shrinking region and lesion, and regions where we have a growing lesion. And this will be easily characterized by the measure of the Jacobian. So for instance, here we have a close-up of the isovalues of the logarithm of the Jacobian around two lesions. Here a peak above 0.7, and here a negative peak around lesion. It's a well, in fact, around a shrinking lesion. And therefore, with simply a threshold on the Jacobian of the deformation field, it's possible to automatically detect evolving regions and quantify actually the amount of variation. Using symmetric energies, it's also possible to show that we obtain exactly, or almost exactly, because of the discretization effects, almost exactly the same regions with a given threshold on the logarithm of the Jacobian with a direct transformation, and with the inverse transformation taking actually the opposite value for the logarithm of the Jacobian. And therefore, David Ray, in his PhD thesis, showed that it was possible to compute 4D maps of the evolution of multiple sclerosis lesions. And this type of tools, of course, can be used for monitoring or evaluating the effect of treatment. And we were actually, at that time when we were doing this study, we were also influenced by the similar work done by with other techniques by Guido Geary. Here he is. On a similar topic. Actually, we were in the same biomorph project at that time. In this European biomorph project, there was also another application of this intensity-based registration techniques to try to characterize brain asymmetry. And the idea here was to try to verify an hypothesis by a neuropsychiatrist, psychiatre, from Oxford called Tim Crow, to verify the hypothesis that there was a difference in the asymmetry of schizophrenic patients with respect to normal patients. Normal controls. So the first stage here was to find the plane minimizing an SSD criterion between homologous points between the two hemispheres, and to place all the images in a reference manner with respect to the mid-sagittal plane. actually the determination of this mid-sagittal plane is a very critical stage when studying asymmetry. And Sylvain Prima, in his PhD, made a very robust implementation for the detection of this mid-sagittal plane. There is a stage where using a block matching registration technique I will describe later, where points in one hemisphere are matched to homologous points in the other hemisphere just by comparing one image with a symmetric image and finding the most similar region. And when enough points are found between the two hemispheres, there is a plane which is drawn, which minimizes the sum of square distances between homologous points. So here we see the automatic alignment with respect to the found mid-sagittal plane for one image of the database. And then once this mid-sagittal plane has been found and the images have been aligned with respect to this plane, it's possible again to compute a deformation field between each hemisphere and its and the symmetrized version of the other hemisphere. So this deformation field is rigid or null in regions which are perfectly symmetric and shows an apparent growing or an apparent shrinking in regions which are larger or respectively smaller in the other hemisphere. And this can be characterized again with differential operators like, for instance, the Jacobian I presented before, or with this type of operators where F, here we have the magnitude, the local magnitude of the deformation field and the divergence. And I show here on a synthetic example where we have actually added, we have modified the image to create on this hemisphere a region which is larger than on this one, and here another region where this is the case. Here is the found deformation field. Here is a color view of the differential operator, and we retrieve easily the regions which are larger in one hemisphere than in the other one, and they appear in blue on one side and in red on the other side. And here it's on a real example. So we see here the two images which are matched. Here's the deformation field, here's the differential operator, and again, this characterizes the asymmetry between the two hemispheres. So in this project, we made a number of studies with a number of controls, a number of patients. Here I am only showing some of the results with 10 controls, which are placed in the same reference frame, and 10 patients, 10 schizophrenics. And initially, we were extremely happy, and Tim Crow was very happy, because we were finding some significant differences between the schizophrenics and the controls. But we had just forgotten to remove a very subtle bias in the MR images. And this bias was almost invisible by the naked eye. But doing a careful suppression of this bias, then we found no statistically meaningful differences. And it was, so the study actually was pursued with more patients, I think up to 40 patients, 40 controls, and no more, no difference, no statistical meaningful differences between the two groups. All right, so this was for the use of intensity-based registration techniques combined with differential operators to characterize changes in shapes for actually single patients and longitudinal studies. The next stage was to compare multimodal images. And at the time we started these studies, there were quite a large number of similarity criterions available to compare such multimodal images, like sum of square differences, correlation, mutual information, with variable costs and performances. And Alexis Roche, in his thesis, try to find a manner to actually characterize which criterion should be optimal for a given pair of images. So he proposed a unifying maximum likelihood framework, which is based on physical and statistical modeling of the image acquisition process. And what is nice with this work, I think, is that it creates actually a hierarchy of criteria, as we shall see, and it leads him to introduce a new criterion, the correlation ratio, which was known, in the statistical community, but was not used in our medical imaging community. And his work was actually following the pioneering work of these people here. Just in one slide, again, as Guido said, it's been a several years study, but just in one slide, the idea is to characterize the formation of the two images through two image acquisition processes, one unknown spatial transformation here, and try to maximize the probability of observing the two images I and J, given the unknown parameters to be optimized of the transformation, and some additional parameters characterizing actually the scene, there's a physical object, and the two acquisition processes. So with this approach, we retrieve that if in this joint histogram that Olivier Fougeras showed this morning, if in the ideal case we have the identity between the two images, of course we retrieve the sum of square differences criterion. If the relationship is an affine relationship, we retrieve the optimal criterion is the correlation coefficient. If the relationship is just a general statistical relationship, we retrieve that mutual information is the best criterion. And what was interesting here is that when the relationship is a functional relationship between the intensities of the two images, as the optimal criterion is the correlation ratio. So we applied this directly to a problem we were working on in another European project called RoboScope, where the purpose was to quantify brain deformation during neurosurgery. And more precisely, to relate the preoperative planning, which is done on anatomical MR images before surgery, with intraoperative ultrasound images, which are taken during surgery. And as you know, when the brain is open, there is a leakage of cerebrospinal fluid, and usually a motion of several centimeters. And it's quite important to take this into account, especially if you are undergoing brain surgery, of course. So the difficult problem here is to relate these images, which are very different in nature, as you can see. And looking at the physics of the ultrasound and MRI formation, we found that as a first approximation, it was reasonable to assume a dependence of the ultrasound signal as a function not only of the MR intensity, but also of the MR gradient, which is not surprising when you know how ultrasound images are formed. And so we ended up with bivariate correlation ratio, where the intensity of the ultrasound image is modeled as a function of the MR image signal and the local gradient magnitude. And the method, again, is an iterated method where there is a robust polynomial approximation of this function given an initial transformation. And for this function given, an estimation of the transformation minimizing this criterion. So the results were quite good. So here we see, for instance, the superimposition of the edges of the MR image on the ultrasound image. And this was actually applied to a large number of images. Alexis Roche and Xavier Penex, they made also a study on the accuracy and also on the robustness of this criterion with respect to others. And it was a nice result to see that, for instance, in terms of robustness, This approach is much better than, for instance, the mutual information. So giving credits to the physical modeling here. So once this registration is done between the MR and the ultrasound, before the opening of the dura mater, it is then possible to track actually the ultrasound image using, for instance, a parallel version of the monomodal non-rigid registration algorithm. And here, on a volunteer pig brain, we see the tracking of a balloon which was inserted in the brain to validate quantitatively the estimation of the deformation. This morning I realized that my talk was faceless, so I added three slides to show you that also this algorithm could be used to register faces of students. Here, Pascal Cachier, and here, Jonathan Stockel, also two former students who emigrated to the United States. Good news for the United States. And here's the middle image. So unfortunately, these two students have glasses, so it's not so impressive. And I took two others who also have glasses, but this one has no beard, and you can see the beard growing here. So I think it's more convincing. Here another example with an intermediate. It works also with women faces. And here an intermediate image, and here an extrapolated image. And the person was very embarrassed seeing this image. A very last example with no longer faces, but for an application for slowing down the motion in video sequences. And so RealVis company was interested in that. And so it's possible to use this non-rigid registration techniques for slowing down the motion, for instance, 10 times. Okay, let's go back to brain images and introduce briefly, some methods that actually combine the geometric approach with the iconic approach. And our first work on that was done in collaboration with SHFJ, CEA, Jean-François Mangin, and Denis Rivière. And the idea was to use the very nice work of Denis Rivière on the labeling of a number of cortical lines to actually guide the iconic registration technique. And this can be done very easily with the previous optimization approach, just adding a term here where we ask for the lines with the same labels to be as close as possible. And we choose, for instance, the closest point from one line to the other one. And here we see a result with three sulcal lines on the first set of five subjects. And so this is the initial distribution of the sulcal. These are not lines, these are ribbons, with just an affine initialization using the iconic registration without any semantic information. And you're using iconic plus geometric. We see a reduction, actually, of the variability of these ribbons, and which is good news because they were actually minimized. The distance between these ribbons were minimized in the registration process. Here, another example with other ribbons, and again with five subjects, and again we see a reduction. So when you look only at the images, the results seem very similar if you use only the iconic registration method and the iconic plus geometric method. But when you look specifically at the ribbons, you see that there is a strong decrease in the variability and so a more plausible result. I will make a small parenthesis here for introducing block matching, essentially for then introducing the polyrigid transformations of Vincent Arsinier. So the context for this work is the building of histological volumes from 2D cross sections, and these cross sections can come from microscopic or macroscopic optical images, or can come also from autoradiographies. And the purpose of having these 3D volumes is then to fuse them, to map them on medical images for localization or validation purposes. And more precisely, what I will show is a work that we did again in a European project called MAPA-WAMO, involving also the group of Olivier Faugeras and coordinated by Guy Urban, and where the objective was to map the visual cortical regions in the awake behaving monkey using functional MRI and to validate the results, the findings in functional MRI with autoradiographies, where you have the ground truth, actually. So the registration problems were first to stack together these hundreds of cross sections where the reference was lost, and then to map the 3D volume against first an anatomical MR image and then a functional MR image. So the approach in Sébastien Ursulin's thesis is actually classical block matching registration technique, where I think the nice part is to, once you have this deformation field obtained for each block independently, there is a robust manner for computing a global rigid or fine transformation. And the method is extremely robust. Actually, the software was transferred to several groups. I think also the Looney group here. And here we see an example where with 300 cross sections, I think we have here the result on the anterior part of the brain. And here's the superimposition of the reconstructed 3D volume on the brain, on the MR image of the monkey brain. And we can see that these are good results. In some cases, the algorithm failed because the hypothesis that there is a rigid transformation allowing the registration of two successive cross sections is too strong. For instance, in some cases, part of the cross section has an independent rigid motion. This was the case for this part here with respect to the rest of the cross section. And so the first idea was to implement a piecewise affine registration, and this was the work of Alain Pitiot and Eric Bardinet. And more recently, the problem is that we don't have here a diffeomorphism, a global diffeomorphism. And if we want to have such global diffeomorphism, Vincent Arcigny proposed to introduce the so-called polyrigid or polyaffine transformations. So the idea is to try to combine together a number of, for instance, in the case of polyrigid transformations, a number of rigid transformations with a number of anchor points, spatially defined, with Gaussian influence and a number of weights. The problem is that if you do a direct averaging of transformation, you get a result which is not invertible. And the idea of Vincent Arcigny was to take for each rigid component, well, to look at the trajectory. The trajectory satisfies an ordinary differential equation, which is given here, where A is the logarithm of the rotation of the rigid transformation. And the idea is, instead of averaging the transformations directly, is to average these speed vectors together and take into account the anchor points and the previous weights. And doing that, it's possible to come back to the global transformation by integrating the resulting flows. And there is a result that this is a diffeomorphism, and it's regular with respect to each of the parameters, which is very important then to optimize these parameters given a deformation field provided by the block matching algorithm. So here we see an example again with these two cross sections. With rigid registration, the difference images show that this part was not correctly registered. With affine registration, it's a little better, but not so good. And with the polyrigid transformations, we find with only four rigid components a very good registration of the two methods. So this was actually done using the ITK library, and this the code is this is to appear in a special issue of this journal on ITK, and the code is made available for people who are interested. So I will enter the very last part of my talk, and now looking at some shape statistics, especially on the sulcal lines. And I will first revisit the regularization of the Pasha in the Pasha algorithm, and the idea that was introduced recently by Xavier Penec and Radu Stefanescu is to actually modulate this regularization as a function of space, taking into account local information. Do we have, for instance, texture or edges to give more confidence, for instance, to the similarity criterion here or to the regularization part? And second, as a function of the local variability. If we have some information on the local variability, we'd like to take it into account when we do the regularization. So I will start with local information. And for instance, the idea here is to regularize with this diffusion equation, where k is high in regions where we have edges or texture, because we have confidence on the similarity term, and so we don't want to regularize too much, and is small in regions where we have uniform regions, or regions where we have a pathology which creates a big discrepancy between the images. Let me show you an example here where we try to match actually this image of a patient after the resection of a tumor with an atlas. So of course this part is not present in the atlas, and so we put low confidence values in this region. And then we obtain a registration of the atlas with the image, which remains correct. We see here the registration result, which remains correct in this region. Whereas if we had not weighted this region with a low confidence value, we would have had a part of the atlas matching these regions by mistake. So this was for the first part. The second part is to take into account the variability. And for that, we propose to use actually this type of regularization, where we introduce diffusion a tensor here, D, which encodes the a priori variability. And so what I will show now in the very last part of this talk is how we can recover this a priori variability from a number of from a database and from tensor computing. Just before I do that, I promised I would give at least one example of computing time. So the very last version of the algorithm, using a parallel implementation on a cluster of 15 PCs and an efficient parallel AOS scheme for the diffusion PDEs, takes about 5 minutes to register two images of this size. So it's still far from being immediate, but it's compatible with a number of clinical applications. So let's move now to the statistics on sulcal lines. And the goal here is to learn the local brand variability from the sulci in order to better constrain intersubject registration using the scheme I presented before, and also use these studies to correlate variability with, for instance, age and pathologies. And we've seen many examples of that before. So this work is collaborative work between our group and the LONI here, and in particular with Paul Thompson, involving Pierre Fillard, who is here, with Xavier Penec, and myself. So the first stage is a computation of from a database of brain images on which the sulci were manually delineated, is to find an average representation of this sulci and the variability around each point of the of these average lines. So Vincent Arcilly proposed an approach using first an approximation of all the instances with B-splines to regularize a little bit these lines, and then a dynamic programming approach to match the mean to instances. and a gradient descent to compute the mean curve position. Actually, it's an alternate minimization. And here we see a result of where in red we have the mean lines for we've used your 80 instances for 7 to sulci. So then, because for each point on the mean curve we have the correspondences on all the instances, it's possible to compute covariance matrices, which are represented here as ellipsoids along each circle line. We see here along one of them, which is Sylvius fissure. And we have about 1,250 tensors to encode the variability of these lines. Then, if we want to go further, we need to do some tensor computing. And tensors are on a manifold. They are symmetric, definite, positive matrices. And we want to make a number of operations, like regularization, interpolation, compression, extrapolation, and also statistical comparisons. So for that, we need to develop tools to compute statistics on manifolds and on tensor computations. And of course, a lot of work was already published on this topic. And we see here a number of people who have inspired our work. So the idea is to choose an affine invariant metric. So we take the action of the linear group here, where if we apply a matrix A an affine transformation to a tensor, here is the action A sigma A transpose. We want to have the infine invariant distance, so the distance between two tensors and between this tensor where we applied A must be the same. And we define the scalar product on the tangent space at the identity on the manifold of tensors in this way. And by definition, also, we define the scalar product between two tensors, between two vectors of the tangent space at any point sigma on the manifold with this computation here brought back to identity. So we can then define geodesics, exponential maps to go from any vector of the tangent space at for any vector sigma on the manifold to any other point, psi on the manifold. And because we have this nice property that the geodesic length here is the same as the magnitude of the vector here in the tangent space, we can define in a rigorous way the distance between two tensors, sigma and psi, with this metric. So using this metric, it's possible to do an interpolation, for instance, between two tensors in a much more natural way than if we do simply an interpolation of the coefficients. And of course, we guarantee also that we stay on the manifold and that, for instance, the positiveness of the eigenvalues is preserved. So we applied this first for the compression of all the covariance tensors along the lines. And for instance, we found that it was sufficient to keep a very small number of tensors, for instance, four of them along each circle line, to retrieve just by interpolation the original set of tensors with the effect of having a more regular description and much more compact. So for instance, here on the initial data set, we keep only 250 tensors, and we can, of course, recreate the initial tensor field with a very good precision. So it's interesting now to look, for instance, at the results on this first database of 80 images. So here we have two views, a frontal view and a view from above, of the tensors. The color here codes uncode the trace. And so we see that in some regions, there is, for instance, there are some very nice, there is very nice symmetry between the tensors, which means that there is a good symmetry in the variability. This is not the case in other regions, and just by using the previous metric, it's possible to quantify this difference in symmetry. In variability between symmetric tensors, that is, tensors in symmetric positions. The next stage is to extrapolate to the complete, to the whole brain, and this is done simply by diffusion algorithms. We, for instance, here in this example, we give four tensors, and we make a smooth extrapolation just by minimizing this energy. So here it's a data attachment term where we have to convolve locally with the Gaussian around the sources to keep differentiable energy. And here the regularization is done with this term. So if we start with this image, actually we initialize with trilinear interpolation. And here is, if we forget the data attachment, we end up with this tensors. If we keep, it's very regular. And here, if we keep, of course, the data attachment, this is a much smoother interpolation that we get. Okay, I'm stuck. No. So these are the very first results, so it's really Pierre Fillard brought them in the plane. I think he runs them in the plane coming here. The interpolation of from the previous circle lines to the whole brain. So here it's shown on the cortex surface. We can look at the trace here. We can look at the principal eigenvector, so with a different coding depending on the on three interesting directions. So this view, I think, is interesting because we were discussing it during lunch with Paul Thompson, and here we see a difference in the variability in the parietal region, which is something that is expected from neuroscientists, I hope so, and also a variability in the temporal and these temporal regions, which is typically in this in the direction inferior superior and also a little in this direction. So these first results seem to be consistent with what is expected. Here another view, and of course we have to now make much more analysis of these very first results. It's also possible to do some anisotropic filtering using this metric to compute accurately, for instance, the gradient between in a tensor field. And so here we have a noisy tensor field. This was the original one, and this is the result of the filtered tensor field. And here a result with real data. Here this is with DTI, the root tensors, using Gaussian filtering with a flat metric, using Gaussian filtering with a previous Riemannian metric without taking into account the gradients, the edges, and here using anisotropic Riemannian metric, and this result is clearly much more satisfying than the previous ones. So the next stages will be to learn variability from the whole database, which is much larger, and make also statistical comparisons between a group of patients or controls, and of course to exploit this learned variability into the non-rigid registration methods I presented before to improve inter-subject registration. And this is now easy to do. We have all the tools for doing that. So during the next 2 minutes, I will just make first a small summary. So I presented a number of registration tools based on geometrical and or physical models developed during the past few years in our group, and also a number of differential operators on deformation fields to detect and quantify local shape variations. I presented also tensor fields computation to encode local variability and adapted tensor metric to compare tensors, and the possibility to actually use this learned variability to improve non-rigid registration. Although it's not done yet, we hope to do this very, very soon. So a few remaining challenges. First one, can we avoid any registration? And I know the question was raised several times. When we do shape statistics, what happens when we just move a little bit the position of one shape with respect to the others? Can we validate non-rigid registration? So there has been some efforts for doing that in the intra-subject case, and for instance, the truth cube at Harvard. It's much more difficult for inter-subject studies, and Xavier Penec proposed a framework using the so-called, it's not the gold standard, it's a bronze standard for doing that, but there is still a lot of work to be done. And finally, I would like just to show you a few slides on the possible use of microscopic imaging for actually detecting shape variations at a microscopic level and try to correlate this with microscopic changes. And I was very interested this morning by the talk of Chenansky, I hope I pronounced correctly your name, on the hippocampus, and also what was said by Guido Gehrig and on the internal structure of the hippocampus. And if we had the possibility to look in vivo at the microscopic level, it would be interesting to detect these very early changes. And actually, there are now some new tools for looking in vivo and in situ at the microscopic level. Cells. For instance, these are images produced by this very small probe, which can be as small as 300 microns in diameter, producing confocal images at the rate of 20 images per second and with a resolution of 2 microns. And here we see, for instance, the bladder of a rat. Here the probe was inserted into the brain of mice, and I don't know if mice have hippocampus. Probably they do. And we see, for instance, here the so using a fluorescence for expressing actually neurons and dendrites. Also the possibility to look at microvessels, and this can be extremely interesting for studying, for instance, the angiogenesis around the formation of tumors and see the effect of a number of treatments. What we see here are just leukocytes, which are just moving, and their size is between 7 and 11 microns. What we see here in these images are the blood cells. And we've shown, for instance, at the last ISB conference that it was possible with exploiting actually artifacts in these images to compute the blood flow in these in vessels as small as 55 microns of diameters in real time. A very last example is the idea of coupling these geometrical and physical models also with physiological models. And for instance, we have a collaboration with Simon Warfield at Brigham and Women's Hospital to study the evolution of tumors and couple this evolution with deformation of the brain. So we've built actually a biomechanical model of the brain for doing that, and also a model of the development of the tumor, taking into account the direction of the fibers. And the idea will be to use these cellular imaging techniques I presented before to actually calibrate the model at the microscopic level. Here we see just an example, and this will be my last slide, of the evolution of this tumor and the deformation field created by the tumor, which was actually validate a posteriori on a study with a patient at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Okay, I want to thank a number of people who are listed here, both from the EPIDOC group and from academic and clinical partners, and thank the audience. Thank you very much.